Hi, and welcome to episode 86 of Fully Boosted, a War Machine Hordes podcast. I'm Grant.
I'm Brad.
I'm Pete.
And this week, we have Mr. Seth Cohen making a return appearance.
Hey there.
Seth is another XPG from our area. Conveniently, the gentleman that's running the Bokor Brawl, in addition to a couple other guys from North Jersey. And this past weekend, we even came down to a steamroller in my neck of the woods, so...
Actually, that's not 100% accurate. I was never officially a PG. I was like a PG attachment. And then right when I submitted all the application stuff, they said, all right, hang on. And then it was like a year, and then they killed the program. So I'm really more one of those guys who picked up when the PGs were killed and, you know, we lost
no.
Folks.
No one actually has done that more than Pete Cerretti.
Stop.
That is
Pete
true.
Applied. Day later. Guys... Sorry, no more PGs.
Pete, you win.
Single-handedly killed the program by signing up. They're like, oh, this is the quality person that we're getting? Fuck this shit.
Yep. We're out. and we're going to shut it down for everyone because fuck you guys.
Yeah. So you're all welcome. No, Seth has done great things in the New Jersey gaming community for years.
He has run...
Events at donated time at both Captain Con and Southern Ontario Open in the last year to help.
Speaking of donating, what are the SOBs donating to Nova?
To Nova or to Captain Con? Because to Captain Con, we're donating another fully painted 75-point army. We're kind of working on what we want those models to be. We're trying to work from what the club kind of already owns, so we have to... You know, so we can limit the amount that folks have to reach into their pocket. But is there something to donate for Nova also? Because no one's reached out to me.
See, all right, my apologies. I just know that there's like an army auction at Nova as well. I assume that's what we were doing. But you're doing the one for Captain Con next year.
I am doing the one for Captain Con next year.
Aha! So what's for the up for auction at Captain Con from the SOBs?
Well, like I said, we're trying to narrow it down, but it is going to be some kind of Forces of Lael type force. You know, the NJSOB Gaming Club, we have always prided ourselves as mercenaries, so we usually pick a mercenary faction to donate. And then this past year, we donated a 75-point army. We had outstanding painters, lots of people donate, SOBs from across the country, right? Folks who were NJSOBs and have moved to other places, donated things to us. So it's really a great community effort. We were just happy to be able to do it.
Yeah, that was super great. It was a great cause. And I saw that army, and it was beautiful. So absolutely worth it. Do you want to talk a little? I mean, we've obviously been talking about the Brawl. Everyone, if you haven't, don't know what it is by now.
Grant?
What?
The man said save the plug till the end.
Oh, I did not. Well, I did not hear that. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Look, you guys have been plugging it, and I so appreciate it. Once upon a time, the Northeast had the East Coast Rumble, and the East Coast Rumble has gone away. And last year, we ran our first Bokor Brawl. It was a one-day team event, and everyone said, you got to make it bigger, you got to make it better, and that's exactly what we did. It's now a five-person team event, and there's a War Machine Weekend wildcard event going on, and there's the Bokor Big Base Brawl, where the top 10 finishers all walk away with a huge base prize. So it's a whole weekend of tournament. There's open play tables. We're doing it in a big, giant VFW hall. The VFW is going to have the bar open for us all day, and it's just going to be an amazing time. Of 32 teams we had planned for, I have 22 slots filled already. Obviously there's room left, but don't wait until the last second and find yourself shut out. And if you don't want to play in the team event, we do have either the wild card event or the big base brawl. And if you just want to come in and play, you can just buy a day pass for that too. The singles events come with lunch on Sunday, and the team event comes with dinner on Friday and lunch on Saturday. And I think that's about all I can say about that.
Nope. I mean, that's fine. And again, we've talked about that, and you can just check out the BokorBrawl.com. There's a Facebook page. You can find it. I trust most of you are intelligent people. I don't know why I trust that, but
no,
I'm going to...
It's good bet.
And real quick, I will
Grant,
apologize.
Are you insulting the fan base or the other people on this cast?
Yes.
Little column A, column B.
Still, I'd make sure on that one, Grant.
No. If anybody, it should be insulting myself. I will apologize. I don't know what this quality is going to be like. Things got messed up. I am on my phone. So if this gets too bad to listen to, I will do my best to edit it out, but I apologize in advance and hope you can power through it with us, because today we are going to be talking SR 2018. This dropped, I think, mid last week. We may have already recorded, so we figured we'd hold off until tonight, and Seth was kind enough to join us to talk about that. So let's get right into it. The first thing out of the packet that I think a lot of people overlooked, and Brad was one of the people kind of...
No. Hold.
Oh, yeah, Brad was all over
no,
that.
No.
Way to go, Brad.
It was Seth.
Well, to my knowledge, it was Brad, because that's who I heard it from. So, Brad, good job catching that, buddy.
I didn't.
Okay. Seth, I'm sorry. I did not know that.
No, it's okay. You know, it's all good. Basically, what we're talking about is under scenario elements, it says, if a scenario element is inadvertently moved during gameplay, pause the clock and reset the zone marker's position. If a scenario scoring occurred while a zone element was in an incorrect position, the control points stand, even if the error is noticed after the fact. So I immediately messaged Brad and I said, holy crap, this conflicts specifically with Death Clock. And, you know, I was talking to Matt Rotunda about it on Sunday, and he said, you know, I see a scenario where somebody scores and then, oh, well, I'm going to check where that position of that scenario element is. So you score on your turn, but then not on your opponent's if it needs to be moved, like that kind of stuff. So I eventually messaged Tim Bankey, and I said, Tim, did you notice this? And, you know, what do you think? And he was not as impressed by this as I was. And he just said, yeah, I'm just going to tell folks not to pause their clock and check it. If they've got a real issue, just, you know, call the TO, call the judge. So I think that's, you know, what I was thinking about doing anyway. And I think that's the way it's going to be handled, at least for me moving forward.
I mean, that's how it was handled before, right? You'd call the TO and...
Right.
I mean, you didn't pause your clock or do anything. You just, like, called a TO and they tried to fix it. I mean, what did you do as a TO in a situation if an element was moved but points were already scored? Did you just say?
You know, I would have – I had the only similar position I've been in is when someone had cut a zone circle inaccurately.
Sure.
And the guy said, oh, well, wait a second. If you draw the line from this correct spot to this part where something's cut away – my model scores. And my answer was, well, have you guys been playing it like that the whole game, or were you playing it as it lay? And the answer was, well, we were playing as it lay. I said, well, then your model doesn't score, right, because you were playing it that way the
sure.
whole time.
Yeah.
You know, without this in here, someone said, I think the marker's in the wrong position. My answer would be this, right? Well, let's move the marker, but this guy scored, right?
So weirdly enough, I didn't even know that was a thing. What I was talking about was the rule about not having to take 15-second turns anymore.
Ah.
But yeah, I let you guys go.
That's definitely
because,
the thing that I stole from you.
Yeah, because I definitely didn't know about this, but I'm glad that we did have that discussion. But the first thing that came up to me, again, that I thought was from Brad, so I'm still going to give him credit, was not having to take a 15-second turn. And you posted it, I think, in the general group or somewhere, and it seemed to get kind of downplayed. And I'm not sure if, like, to me, that's a pretty significant change. And not a change, but that's a pretty significant, I think that has a bigger impact than what some people, at least in that particular conversation, were leading on. Do you want to talk about that at all, Brad? Because I think you were kind of heading that one.
Well, the 15-second...
Yeah, a lot of people seem to, like, downplay it. So.
I mean, yeah, it's something to downplay. It doesn't come up often. I think in all the games that the majority of us play, it's something that usually won't come up. And unless you're playing in a steamroll, it's probably not a rule that you're going to enforce. With that all being said, though, I think that for those of us that do go to steamrollers and then the smaller minority that even travel to conventions then, when this rule matters, it really matters. So what you end up seeing happen is a player gets down to maybe a minute left on their clock, and it's only round five, and scenario points are just about even. So they know they've got to go the length of the game. even to try and get a draw, just by like running things quickly and going, as fast as they can. Well, in the spirit of doing things as fast as they can, maybe that, Warjack that's towing his own doesn't really matter. Maybe they just have to run two solos to get next to some flags and then call it done. Well, that's fine, but you still have to go through the required parts of the turn.
Yep, that is correct.
What that means is you'll have to remove focus in excess of your focus on a Warcaster, say if you had something through Cull Soul, something like that, or Testament's Models dying into control area to gain souls. And, if you have 10 being your turn, your focus 7 Warcaster, you have to remove down to 7. Or Warjacks that still have focus on them from the previous turn, you have to remove that off. Then you have to do your power-up or continuous effects of things are on fire, corroded, all of those things. So in those circumstances, trying to save the time to just run those models you need, you have to do those steps first. Or let's say you don't even have to do those things. You just have to like spend your time because you're up by 4 and your opponent has no way to really score. There'd be instances where a player might only have 20 seconds left. They'd take their round 6 and 7 because they're not able to score anymore, neither is their opponent. But they just don't have the time to do so, so their opponent will win on clock. So all the changes is now. Is if you're able to do all the compulsory things, powering up, continuous effects, even with Vengeance. Vengeance is technically a compulsory thing, but you can say, I'm going to activate this unit for Vengeance, and they're done.
Move zero, done.
Right, yep. And I'm going to choose not to make any attacks, and then move to the next. As long as you're remembering to go through those steps. Things that are not mandatory. Technically, you don't have to re-Fury from Warbeast.
That's correct.
But you are then required to take the frenzy checks. So a little bit of a catch-22. So frenzying can eat up a good bit of time.
I was just going to say, the reason, Grant, I think you did not see a big splash on that issue is they were teasing, not teasing, that's the wrong word, but in CID they were saying that's probably something they were going to get rid of.
Right, yeah, I mean, that wasn't a change I was surprised to see.
Yeah, so, I mean, I even put in the Boker Brawl players packet, which is available at the bottom of the front page of the BokerBrawl.com. I even put something in the players packet that said, if there are not minimum turns, you need to complete all the steps of your mandatory except, like, just what Brad was saying.
Sure.
So, in anticipation, I put that in there, and I think that's the way most folks are going to be handling that moving forward.
Sure.
So, well, I was going to say, so this happened to me at a big con in which there was a minimum turn enforcement and there was a clock issue. We were using an analog clock. It was the worst.
Yep. That was what I was talking about.
So one of the things I see happening is, okay, got the opponent across from me has 10 seconds left. They do like one thing. They say, I activate nothing and slap the clock. So now that's eating on your clock, and you have that argument with them of you have to do your minimum turn. Like, you did not execute a minimum turn. And, like, that is the exact situation that happened to me. What's the best way to resolve that, do you guys think?
So it's actually kind of outlined in the document. Anytime a player's under 5 minutes, you can ask the TO to observe the end of the game. At which point, if a player's doing that, it's on the shoulders of the TO to pause the clock and then give the warning to the player that isn't doing what they have to do to constitute a turn.
Okay. Well, that's good.
That is accurate. And it's interesting because that player, truthfully just trying to understand how that situation should be handled moving forward, said, so really the expectation is that I pick the focus up off my jack, and then when I go to power up, I just put it back down. And all the judges looked at this person and said, yes, right? That's when you're that time sensitive and you have to do all your steps, you have to do all your steps, and that's what that means.
So, I mean, I just want to throw a quick caveat in here. If you're playing in a local steamroller, I don't think I'm going to be the guy to go ahead and enforce it's that level. Let me rephrase that. If I'm playing the steamroller and, it's the second round and time is in no way an issue, I'm not going to be the guy enforcing it. If there's still a focus on this model and you still have power up and, this is their power up, and I'm fine with it. But once the game gets down to those, nitty gritty final turns, I think it's reasonable that both of you, both players in this instance should hold each other to taking those compulsory things. So I think similar to how some players say they'll pass the clock later in the game for tough checks when both players are tight on time, and some players think you should do it all the way through the game. You know, I kind of waver that I don't think you need to be as strict with the whole focus thing in the beginning, but then really need to kind of crack down on it
right.
at the end, which I guess is not a great way to do it, but I can say personally that's how I go about it, which maybe I'll rethink going forward. But
and I think you hit on an interesting point, because if you are a person that goes to conventions, or probably most game stores that bought them in bulk, most clocks at big events are analog, and that can be a problem when you're trying to tell. I mean, this happened in a game at Captain Con with me and JVM, which, let's be clear, I wasn't going to win that. Anyways, it didn't matter. But it came down to where, like, Zosha had to was watching the clock because we were trying to both make sure, like, we could take those turns. Like, it was it mattered, and nobody could tell. We couldn't tell if I had 15 seconds left on my clock.
Right. Well, Captain Con's going to have digital next year.
Understood.
I feel bad.
I say that because we bought our clocks together, because the Brawl has digital as well.
I feel bad that we're like jabbing in and around Captain Con's soft underbelly, but that's only just because that stuff happened to us there.
We were there. Yeah. It's not their fault. Most places, especially when you're setting up that many tables, they do use analog clocks. I mean, it's not a thing that I'm saying to pick on them. It's just that happened to me and you while we were at this event. The event was still great. The clocks didn't matter. But you go to a lot of tournaments and you see a lot of people bring their digital clocks. I mean, it gets difficult. I've had games that come down where I couldn't tell if me or my opponent could take 15-second turns. So what am I supposed to do? On my clock, get out my stopwatch on my phone and start timing 15 seconds? It gets tricky. This is a good change that was unnecessary. I don't know why that was in there anyway, because it's like you said, if you can take all the compulsory things in a turn you need to do and still score your points. I mean, I've ended turns with 14 seconds on my clock and be like, okay, good game, because I can't now take another turn.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've shot myself.
I've
shot myself in the foot by doing that. You know, I was like, oh, you have 18 seconds left. I'm going to run my clock down to 15.
Yep.
And smirk at him and pass the turn, and then realize, crap, I should have ran it down to 18 and passed, because now they're going to have 3 more seconds than I do. So
I just want to point out one thing before we get corrected by the internet later. If a player would to score to a difference of 5 control points, even if their clock ran out, they still win the game.
Yeah.
So being under 15 seconds doesn't automatically mean that you lose the game if it's not round 7. I just know that we'd have someone correct us.
Yeah.
I've seen people win games like that. So, I mean, yes, that is correct, and we should have led with that caveat. But
or you can just kill their caster. I mean, just, you know. Yep.
Yes, that is always an option. So I think one of the things as a tournament organizer, I am going to make it a point to, during the pre-event speech, is to, you know, make sure that I inform all the players that, hey, you know, this is the rule. There's no 15-second minimum turns, but you do have to do your mandatory items.
Right.
And just walk through that checklist of you have to do this, you have to do that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you are correct.
Is this a Fiora 1 buff?
Because of the fire.
Just light everything on fire.
She sets everything on fire in her control. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think so.
It's not. She's still bad. right. I think that is enough of that. That was a small thing. Let's get into the stuff everybody cares about, these scenarios themselves. I'm not going to talk about the Pit 2 standoff or Spread the Net, because they are the same.
Keep going.
Can we start at 6? Because it's the least different.
We will get to 6, but yes, let's start with 6 because it's the least changed. Recon 2 is, I believe, exactly the same, except the flags on the back end of your respective rectangular zone are now on the left edge of the zone instead of in the middle where they were before.
They've moved 3 inches.
Yep. 3 inches to the left when you're looking at your side.
Yep.
I have not played New Recon 2.
We did.
Was that change significant?
You shouldn't have had another wedding, Grant.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, when I first looked at this scenario, I thought, hey, you know, I could have a medium or large base model or a small base model with 2 inches of reach, attack the objective and be contesting the flag. But how often is that going to come up? And of course, it came up while I was playing the scenario. So that was interesting. You know, going.
Does the objective contest your own flag?
It's not close enough. It's not within four.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. But you know, you go after your opponent's objective and you're contesting the flag at the same time. It's a nice little bonus there. So that was neat.
That is interesting. I didn't think about that when I looked at the that scenario.
Yeah. But other than that, to me, and you guys jump in with your opinions, obviously, but to me it felt pretty much the same.
So I can give you my two quick takeaways. One, the lists that utilize ambush now have a tougher time of ambushing to run in and contest that flag.
Mm-hmm.
With it being set just those 3 inches farther in. The unit kind of has to, or the models that are going into contest have to choose between usually charging and now running, mm-hmm. You know, which can be a significant drop-off if your opponent's giving you things to charge on the ambush. The other thing is with that change to the middle and with your own flag then moving to the middle, so like in terms of what you have to be conscious of scoring and not allowing your opponent to score, there's a total of like a 6-inch shift, and it's all towards the middle. With the objectives already being there and the zones only 12 inches apart, this feels very much now like a scenario the Bricks really want to play on. They can stay right in the middle of the table. They can put kind of their anchors on either end of their formation. They can be in both zones, and if they're up far enough, they can be contesting your flag while not being moved either. It feels, even though it's only that 3 inches slide per each flag, it feels now set up a little bit better to be played on by a brick style list.
I also think, and again, I haven't played it, but I'm just looking at it and thinking, with more line of sight blocking terrain in either A, the dead center of the table, or somewhere around there, I feel like it being over the few inches could make the difference between you being able to park a solo on that flag and possibly be hidden by that line of sight blocking terrain. Whereas before, again, you could have been depending on the table, but it seems more likely to me now than it may have been in the last recon. Is that fair?
Maybe. You know, you can never tell with terrain. You just don't know what stores have access to, what people are putting on the table. But I understand your point.
How live would we call recon on a 1-6 looking at this packet?
That's a ridiculous scale, Grant, but for you, I'll try.
Well, whatever. Pick a fucking, I don't care. I'm just saying because there's 6 scenarios. Like, whatever, make it 1-10 then. I don't know why that's that ridiculous.
1-1,000.
Yeah, 1-23, Brad.
On a scale of 3-14, where would you place it?
Like, I don't, there's 6 scenarios, man. Like, I don't know. That didn't seem that crazy, but okay, I get it.
All right, so for comparing them against each other, like, I think Mirage, which we'll get to, is the front runner.
Obviously.
Yeah, I think Mirage is the front runner. I think it's an either standoff, and it's either standoff after it or then Recon 2. I'd probably go Recon 2. So on a scale of 1-6, I guess 6 being the best in terms of aliveness, I'd give it a 5.
Okay, great. Fine. All right. I won't do that again. My bad. my question was, how live was Recon in the old packet? But fuck you, we're moving on. I don't care anymore.
I think it was really live before. I think it was one of the ones that usually had higher, scores run higher off on it more than others.
Yeah, it was definitely a point farmer of a scenario.
Yep.
You know, my biggest complaint, obviously, is the ambush, because a Gatorman Husk will not get there. He's going to come in 3 off the edge. He's going to run 10, and he's going to be 5 inches away from the flag.
What if there's a Witch Doc Croc ready to set that up with the Death Ride?
If you can do that on turn 2, you're a better player than I am.
Yeah, you can do that. You don't need the point.
So, Pete, he can't score, but ambushers can still come in and contest that flag. I mean, 3 inches in, you only need to be 4 inches away. You only need to run 11 inches, right, to be able to...
And it's speed 5, Grant, what are you saying?
Yeah. Gatorman Husk doesn't get there.
Gotcha. Okay.
If you're so real quick, is it possible to get it in Death Ride? So if you go second, you deploy at 12 inches. How far does the the Woodstock run turn one?
There's speed fives as well. So
you're at 22, then you walk to 27, and it's a command what?
Command 7.
2734, and that flag is 2418 off the back. Yeah, you could catch him.
Yeah, you could, and then you lose your witch doc. So
hey, look at that, Pete. Problem solved. Way
yep.
to go, Brett.
I just have to totally
run a witch doc rock on the flank of the table.
Yes, yeah. broadcast. I'm going to be broadcasting my intention clear and obvious. You know.
Yeah.
Great.
Fine.
All right.
Okay.
All right. That's enough of recon because, like we said, that scenario did not change much at all. So let's start back at 4. Which is now invasion. I don't remember which one that was before, but it doesn't matter.
Breakdown,
right. So invasion has two circles, 6 inches in from the right edge and center, 24 inches up the table. And then in the center of the table is a vertical rectangle zone that is 18 inches to the back edge. And on each side of that, there is objectives.
Each side meaning the
each
short
side.
Edge.
Each short edge side, yes. So kind of like a 0-1-0 and then objectives on either side of that rectangle, just like, you know, there have been before. So I have not played this one. I imagine some of you guys have. So thoughts?
So everyone in this chat or everyone in the Skype call has played it because we played all the new scenarios at the Steam War that you had a wedding that you couldn't attend to.
Correct.
I think he should rub that in some more because he's not getting it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if you want to tell my wife, that would be fine. Because
I mean, what have we told you about friends outside of War Machine?
I know.
I'll message her right now.
Oh my
god! You'll get we'll get her live reaction on air when she messages like, "Why is Brad bothering me?"
Nice.
All right, talk to me about this scenario, boys.
So it's breakdown. The big change is now there's an additional scoring element in the objective that also makes it so that there's also now a largest advantage for going first. Like what would happen before is you'd have people complain, and rightly so, that the player going first, especially in lists that were tremendously quick, could run turn one. Turn two, they could charge and then run again and run to engage if they were difficult to remove models. To give an example, let's take like a Vlad II Armored Core.
Sure.
So he takes Mana Wars, he feats on all of them, they all run top of two, and they stand in front of you so you're not able to get in the snare elements. And it's very reasonable that they score one on bottom of two in the center rectangle. And then they spend their turn trying to clear one or both circles, and now they're at a 2-0 or 3-0 lead on a scenario that has almost nothing to score on. So it can put you tremendously behind. The big change now is that a player going first can only reasonably, and this is like a real big stretch, assuming that you as the player going second can cede the table, the most they can score is 2 points on bottom of two, which means that they have a unit entirely within both circles and you have no models in either of them because it is impossible for them to destroy your objective before their turn three. Which I think, for having few scoring elements, gives a little bit of a, I don't want to say incentive, but another reason to go second on this scenario. It gives you the ability to try and clear your opponent's objective first, as well as then score the center rectangle. With it being vertical, it makes it very hard for your opponent to meaningfully contest it, because at least on their side of the table, there isn't a lot of space that wouldn't have you just having models be heavily congested on top of themselves, which is generally not how you want to position your models.
That was a pretty good rundown of that scenario, Brad. Well done.
Thanks.
Yeah, no worries. I think I played Cole Westbrook first round with this scenario. And, you know, of course, playing Cole, my goal was simply to not let him, like, you know, top up to me and then, you know, we're outside hanging out. And then what we found was that, and I was playing a Man of War list, I wasn't playing Vlad II, but if dice rolls had gone a little bit differently on my turn two, I would have had those two circle zones. And it's funny, you kind of described what I was trying for. And it was a good scenario. Having the additional, the objective there now really added, at least for me, really added an element. I had to focus on those circle zones a little more, what I could definitely get done with them. And then can I get something to reach over to that objective? And, you know, with the line of sight blocking terrain now, I enjoy playing this scenario. And someone else can talk now because I'm done.
Yeah. Again, I didn't play it, so I assumed Pete was going to say something.
Yeah, I was waiting until it was my turn. So at the tournament, I messed up my list drop and dropped Jaga Jaga Twin Meat Threshers into Zadesh 2, and it was a bad time. So the scenario wasn't a factor. But this morning, I played with my wife, who's playing Denny 1 Slaughter Fleet, and I took Abby 1 into it. And it was an interesting thing because I put scenario pressure on her quick by killing her objective, and then she proceeded to feat. And I put Abby right behind my objective because I was like, I'm going to be safe. So she feated. She was able to get a arc node onto Abby and parasite her and then killed her with blast damage off the objective. So it's one of those things where you definitely need to be cognizant about where your model is going because you want to be center, but it was easier to hit than an elusive ashen-veiled Abby 1. So The objectives definitely make it kind of hampers the amount of room that you have to actually navigate, and you know, usually there's that line of sight blocking terrain in the middle, so that even constricts your movement. So it's an interesting scenario. It definitely favors more of your scenario or terrain independent models, like all of Crix and a bunch of Pathfinder kind of things. So
in my game against, or my game on this, or at least the most recent game on it, you know, there was a line of sight blocking piece of terrain in the middle, just as Pete was describing. And I was playing against a brick with a list that generally needs to kind of go in waves. So I played the sides of the table. The forest in the middle kind of defended my objective for me until about round three, maybe four. I forget when he was able to get onto it, because I was, you know, of course, not just letting him walk to it. So I was able to kind of take the sides of the table and, like, pick a circle and score one circle at a time, kind of in alternating turns, and just play a contesting game. So I don't think generally that's going to be the way it goes, but to kind of echo with what Pete's saying with that line of sight blocking piece of terrain in the middle, if you can turn it into an east-west game and use that line of sight blocking piece of terrain to be your best friend and helping you contest that center rectangle, you know, you can turn up the pressure in a way that they may not have been expecting.
Very true.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to kind of talk about, I mean, again, it's difficult having come on and not played. This one feels a little, it looks live, but then I think about what Breakdown was, where, you know, obviously you didn't have the objectives, but turning that sideways, and it feels, which I know is a lot more real estate coming from looking at the center of the table, right? Like, pushing everything towards the center. When it's wide, when it's horizontally, you obviously have a lot more zone to be in, especially as like a bricky list. So this feels more live than that.
So it's the exact same volume on the table. The difference is in terms of like the ability to make it so your models aren't standing right next to each other in a zone. Now you have about 6 inches of width compared to 12. Sure. So, like, if you're looking to contest the corners, but here's the other like huge change, and I think it's something that we're not talking about enough, especially when it comes to this scenario. Before, and I'm going to use Signar for our example here, Grant. You're playing any caster that has a Stormwall in its list and Junior, right? So you throw Arcane Shield up on a Junior. I'm sorry, on the Stormwall from Junior. You have Stormwall kind of mosey his way up to the middle of the table, and this Armor 22 nonsense idiot is standing in both the rectangle and the circle. So this already not tremendously live scenario element. It just become a, you know, just became a one thing to score for your opponent a turn scenario, and it's the other circle that the Stormwall isn't in.
Right.
So, can a huge base still contest both scenario elements now? I believe so. I haven't put the base down to check at its widest point in a circle if a huge base will fit. But in I'm fairly certain it does. But
in almost 18, it does.
But in almost any other circumstance, insert like tough to remove model, Tiberian, Deathjack, Imperatus, like all of these huge base. I'm sorry, not huge, large base models that. You know, in this scenario, once you got like the 1 point lead, you'd sit it on the line and it played goalie and it just sat there forever and made it so that your opponent could only score one thing. And until they could kill your impossible to kill heavy, you just had to fight for one circle because they had no ability to remove that one piece. Now, aside from huge bases, which probably bad example to start with, aside from huge bases, you can no longer do. So not only is there an objective that lets you score something else in this scenario, but now there's no my heavy stops you from scoring two things.
Well, and that's why I was saying it feels more live than what I'm going to call the previous iteration of this scenario, but it's not Mirage, it's not Spread the Net, it's not Standoff. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's more live than Breakdown was, but it's still still like the bottom two, I would say, of the least live scenarios in the pack.
Again, just to use I played against Dreamer, so it was the Pat Dunford list, the triple Cage Rager, double Skin and Moans, Death Knell list. So if I was to play this on old Breakdown, just about guaranteed there's a Cage Rager standing on both the lines in between the rectangles and circles, and until I can kill a Cage Rager with my list that has a tough time killing those guys, I just can't score anything. The way it played out this game, so he went heavy for that center rectangle. I played for the outside circle, was able to kill his objective like on round three. So we were kind of scoring point for point, but I was able to start scoring first. So I was up by two for the majority of the game. That's kind of how the game rounded out, with me up by two towards the end. But if this was Breakdown, I don't think either of us are reasonably scoring, unless he does on the center rectangle, until like round four or five when we're both just, you know, heavily running out of models.
Gotcha. All right.
All right. So lastly, we have Mirage, which is
an extremely
interesting scenario.
Go ahead. You know, my first thought, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to walk all over you there, Grant. But, you know, as a con organizer, con with a small C organizer, when this one hit CID, my first thought was, holy crap, I've got to go buy 80 more flags.
Right?
Yep. And then I'm like, please don't let this survive. And, of course, it did. So I have to go buy 80 more flags with the
Poker Ball logo. I'll describe the scenario, and then we'll talk about some of the issues and things that happened in CID and then where we ended up. So looking at the table from your side, on the left side, you have a circle that is the center is 17 inches up from your table edge and 19 inches in from your left edge. There is a objective in the center of that. There is a flag on your right that is 20 inches up and 15 inches in from the right side. That is mirrored then on your opponent's side. And then in the middle of the table, there is another flag. So you have like a backwards percent sign booby thing kind of going on.
the objectives really help that picture make that picture look like boobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it is smack nipples right in the center of those circles.
Yeah. So if you're counting, you could score 6 points in a turn on this scenario, theoretically. You have a flag in the center of the table, which in CID was taken out because of the issue of a lot of times you end up with an obstruction in the center of the table, which means that you have to move the terrain significantly around because it can't be there. So there were some issues where at one point they took the flag out, and now that we see it's back in. This does look like somewhat of a nightmare to set up at 80 tables if I was running a con. If you want a live scenario, this one seems like you need to. This is another one where like going second seems really. Actually, no. Do you want to go second on this one or first?
So,
help me.
I don't think we know yet.
Yeah. That's accurate.
So there's the same frame of mind you have in every scenario. If you get to go first, you get to take a lot of table space, which can be very good because you can set the line of engagement well in front of your circle, making it very easy for your caster to score it. Place some defensive solo back on your flag and have some tough to remove kind of melee solo up on the middle one, and you have a great position to try and score three while contesting their flag and contesting their circle. The flip side of going second is if you can kind of break that, you know, line of engagement in front of their circle, it's very easy to get into that circle. It's only 1 inch behind the center line in terms of where it is for your opponent's circle. The flag is 20 inches up, which means if you get to the center line, you're contesting their flag. And the objective is, what was it, 17 forward?
Yes.
So it's only 1 inch farther back than like the Recon 2 objective, which is not all that hard to get to. Same with Invasion. It's only 1 inch farther back, and it's off to the side. So the models that really want to utilize the objective to help fight things on the table, like say, for example, Gremlin Swarms. If they play on the opposite side of the table, away from the objective, they can just continually contest your opponent's flag. And with the way the objective is, it makes it difficult for like an objective to give a model magic weapons, and then for that same model to then get over and fight the Gremlin Swarm. So it remains to be seen, and I think it's probably going to be much more of a list-by-list, you know, thing to decide. If you're playing against a Lar or two with all the halves, you probably want to go first, because they're going to take so much table space away from you.
Yeah.
That you're not going to be scoring at all on bottom of two.
I think my first thought was that you wanted to go first to take that real estate because it becomes difficult for the opponent to get something meaningful in range of that center flag that you don't just take off. Although I guess you get to then have the first chance to score. So I don't know. You're probably right then.
I didn't get to play this scenario because this was my bye round. Also my only win of the day, but that's not important right now.
Nice. And,
yeah, it was a great day. No, I had a lot of fun. I'm just teasing. But I played a lot of Watch Machine that round, and it did very much seem to me that if you could, I mean, looking at the different tables, if you could threaten, get to touch that far circle, right, your opponent's circle, you know, that was the leverage. It wasn't that center flag it seemed to be the real key. It was, well, if you're getting to that circle and that other objective, well, then by default, you're also, you know, contesting that flag 4 inches into that circle you're contesting as well, right?
And most likely scoring your own flag because, yeah, right.
So, you know, I was watching one game. Someone was being overly defensive, almost making a little half circle there. So the middle flag and their own flag was what they were going to hold, and they were going to continually contest their own circle, and that just didn't work. That person just kept collapsing from the second player, their right side, right, just collapsing toward that far circle, and that person lost. But that was Watch Machine, so I didn't play it, so I don't want to, you know, say definitively.
Pete, did you go first or second in your game on the scenario?
Trying to remember, I believe I went second, but it didn't matter because my opponent had double cavalry, so that was a treat. The way our board was set up, in my zone, there was a house or objective that was diagonal to the table, or diagonal to the flags, so that created kind of a buffer where I had to like go forward and to the left to get around it, and he is already engaged at that line, and he was able to bring the cavalry. They just ran turn one and turn two to come around that house and engage me at my back of my zone, and I missed the ambush. So I never know the right time to do ambush in the steps. I always say I'm probably doing this wrong, and it was one of those things where my opponent was like, yes, you're doing it wrong. So I stopped and I looked it up and I read it and I was like, okay, cool. I think I know now in the future when to do it. And then I went on with the rest of my turn and I was like, I forgot to put the model on the table. Awesome.
That's what I was going to say. That's the most, for most people, the right turn to ambush or the right time to ambush is never, and you forget until the end of the game.
Yeah, I'm saying.
So, Pete, for those listening at home, when is the right time to ambush?
It is during your control phase. So it's prior to all the mandatory control phase stuff at that time of when you can do the rest of your control phase stuff.
So in layman's terms, you do it before you do anything else.
Except vengeance?
Well, vengeance is during maintenance.
Vengeance is maintenance.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Yeah, it was one of those. I was playing a Barney 2 list that had a Sacrivolt. It had Bogtrog, Shamblers. So I had a lot of maintenance control stuff going on, and like I said, you know, there's Barney too. He can spend corpse tokens to bring back his bone shakers. So it's one of those things.
I think the Facebook group has a like printout of like ordered up stuff.
I'm totally gonna make one. I bought a notebook to do that because it's just one of those things where I feel bad if I've done something incorrectly. So yeah, I need to fix that for sure, because every other game I was like, yeah, I totally cheated on all those things.
So was that a high scoring game for you?
Let's see. I lost. Was that my 5-0? I think that might have been 5-0.
Okay. Brad, I'm just curious if that, because that one, I guess it's not necessarily going to be high. That one seems like it's going to be a super fucking fast scenario on that one. Like scenario win for somebody probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I also went second. I was also playing against Double Cav. This person was playing Striker 2, Double Storm Lances. They had a Storm Strider. I think Old Rowdy was there.
Yep, standard.
Yeah.
My opponent had a Reliant. It was amazing.
So I'm playing Dark Coast. It's being run by Denny 2, my old favorite. So, I was kind of set up the same way that Seth was talking about. I set up in almost like a catcher's mitt. So nothing was in charge range of Storm Lances on that turn because, you know, if I do, everything dies. The only thing I did bottom of one is I ran an Arcanid within 8 inches of one of the Storm Lance units. And then arced a Curse of Shadows, and then both of my Stalkers just ran to each engage 2 Storm Lances. Reasoning behind that is I had my Cavalry also on that side, so I have 1 unit of Bane Riders. So they set up behind those Storm Lances.
Hold on. Mm-hmm. So you actually messaged my wife?
Oh, 100%.
That's awesome.
Nice.
I was like, why is she texting me talking to me about weddings? Like, what is happening? She's not even mad. She's just like, we don't even go to that many weddings. Like,
it seems like you go to a lot of weddings.
I agree.
Wait, did we just uncover that your going to wedding is an excuse to just say, fuck it, I don't want to go to your tournament?
The 2 things I have this year that have been a conflict was this one that was during a Steamroller and the Bokor Brawl one, which I've had to tell like a bunch of people about because we were talking about teams and going and playing. So I think that's just why it's come up so much. That's awesome. Good stuff. All right, continue.
The Cursed Shadow is there, so if he gives me free strike, like, my hope was that he, like, moves Arcane Shield on the Storm Lances and, like, all right, good, and take your free strikes. Not knowing that, like, the Stalkers have Blessed, so, like, doesn't matter when he does it anyway. So he knew that and didn't do that. So his turn was, like, spent with Storm Lances just punching Stalkers in the face, so they died, but, like, it's fine. So that all happened. He kind of plays a little back on the left side. Like on, when I say left, his left, my right, where my flag is at. So my turn, my bottom of 2, consists of me going in, killing 3 of the 5 Storm Lances. I kill Old Rowdy, and that's just about it, but by killing those models with where he positioned himself on the table, I was able to score my flag with Denegra. I was able to score the center flag with a Soul Trapper and score my circle with a unit of Bane Warriors. So I'm up 3-0 on bottom of two.
Yeah, this scenario seems very much that, I don't want to say a newer player, but someone that's not being super aware of how many models they're throwing to contest these flags in zone can easily find themselves down 3 or 4-0, bottom of 2, top of 3, whatever.
Well, that's exactly what happened to one of the newer players. It was one of these situations where they were so concerned about losing models that they weren't paying attention to all the different scenario elements. And fortunately, their opponent was like, okay, I'm just going to grind this out with you because, you know, you're a newer player and I just don't want to take all the scenario elements and win, you know. But, yeah, that actually happened to someone while I was watching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I could easily just see, like, okay, I got, you know, 2 or 3 things here, 2 or 3 things there, and all of a sudden somebody feats or whatever has on and kill the objective, and they're like, okay, I score 4, and you're like, oh, fuck. So, like, I got to score at least, depending on what they score, like, I got to contest and still somehow score, like, 2 points to, like, stay in this game.
Yep.
This one seemed super, super fast.
Yeah, so just to kind of continue with my game went, my opponent was able to kind of re-clear the model I had contesting his circle. He was able to clear his flag, but in doing so didn't have a solo that could get onto the flag. So the choice was either solo goes on the flag and it's still contested, or he kills the model contesting it but isn't able to score it. The one with the latter, because that means in the next turn he can score it. The Storm Strider gets Arcane Shielded. It walks to the middle of the table. There's like no way I'm dislodging that with what I have left. So the center flag, I'm still contesting. He doesn't have a solo on it, but the Storm Strider's there, and I'm not clearing it. Also then contest my circle. So at the end of turn 3, top of 3, it's still me at 3 and him at 1. So my turn consists of Tartars killing his objective, which then also conveniently contests his circle. I clear my flag with Denegra just Dark Banishing guys out of there. And then the Bane Warriors and remaining Bane Rider clear the circle zone for me to score another 3, contest everything, and win 6-1. So I think that the key difference is with Recon 2, I think a lot of games kind of translated to becoming East-West games, where I have my flag in my rectangle and you have your flag in your rectangle. And, you know, each player, you know, the players kind of go back and forth, each scoring 2, while running, like, a model into the rectangle to contest both elements in one go. I think in Mirage, which is, you know, it of course has more things that are viable scoring elements than Recon 2, I think the difference is that the games probably won't translate east-west as much because of where the circles are positioned. Even though they're an inch behind the center line, so they're wholly on your side of the table, they cross the center line vertically. So they're 19 inches in, which means the farthest edge over is at the 25-inch mark, which is the same true for them. So there's like 2 inches in the middle of the table where the circles are kind of directly across from each other. Whereas in Recon, you know, there's that 12-inch gap in the middle where there's no zone to contest models. So I think these games are going to be ones where someone's either going to like 5-0 their opponent or like 6-1 or 7-2. Like I don't think you're going to have a lot of...
I don't see a lot of like, yeah, 16-11s. Yeah, it's not going to happen on this scenario.
Yeah.
I mean, the 16-11s are definitely the exception, like definitely not what usually happens in Recon 2. But I think in just this past weekend in a Steamroller I was running, I should say, we had someone's game in Recon 2 end 15-10.
Yeah.
I don't anticipate that happening much in Mirage.
No, I don't either. So a couple quick observations, like I'm not making this has been made before. There are objectives in 5 of the 6 scenarios, whereas previously I believe it was half. I believe it was 3 out of 6.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a? That's weird because I this is what I heard. Is that a like fuck you to Gremlin Swarms, or just they wanted more scenario elements on the table?
Well, it seems to me that they leveraged the nature of the objective to make, you know, certainly one scenario more live. So I don't think it was specifically designed for that. You know, the fact that they can test your own zone, it changes the dynamic dramatically. And I think they did a good job with it. I mean, I've been playing this game a very, very long time. I think the second year it came out. And I've learned to trust that the Steamroller documents, you know, even with their occasional clunker scenarios, on the whole, come out to be a lot of fun and very challenging. And that's kind of my feeling when I look at all the different objective markers through the different scenarios.
And another note that I found is, so if you took, and 2016 I know is not really a great example to relate to, but if you look at from where we went there with scenarios to where we are now, and even last year's packet, because if you would have asked me last year, the way that they talked about scenario, I mean, we were at a place where they basically said that they did not want scenario to be the main means of winning games. And then we went to where we had like two live scenarios and the rest were like kind of, but not super live. I think the exception of like the Pit 2 and possibly Invasion, like these are live scenarios. Like what do you think happened? Like, how are we back into a place where like scenario is probably going to be the way most games are won?
Yeah, well, I mean, they say lots of things, okay? So first of all, you know,
I know.
I remember at one point when they said they would never have plastic models, okay? It was all going to be metal all the time. So, you know, there's that. But I think with the speed of the game now, I think it almost definitely calls for more live scenarios. I could be a minority opinion there, but you know, things just seem so darn fast, and with the changes to Tough and everything else, lots of stuff dies a lot more often, and I think you need the scenarios to be more alive. But you know, that's just me.
So I think it kind of goes. I think when you turn up how live a scenario is, you can also, in turn, change how often a game will be won on scenario. So what I mean by that is, like with the new Mirage, Kruger 2 like found a brand new home, like another one, where he's very happy to play the scenario and can very easily score very quickly. The downside is that Kruger 2 isn't always the most survivable of casters. I think with the addition of Mirage and Recon still staying generally the same, and Standoff, even though it's balanced on both sides and both of you have a defensive scenario element, the person that can get up by two or three and make it very difficult for your opponent to score their own zone is in a really good spot. So I think with kind of going back to Mirage and Recon, with these scenarios that become much more live, I think we might see casters that have a lot of their focus being scenario really make a resurgence. The Kruger 2s, the Magnuses of the world, not that they already weren't seen now, but
the Haley 2s.
Yeah, I think those guys might come back, but the downside traditionally with those casters is that they're the ones that get assassinated more easily than others.
Yeah, but that's not why they weren't getting... I mean, that's not why Haley wasn't getting play. I mean, a caster dying, there's casters that are easy to kill that aren't great on scoring scenario. Like, that doesn't... I don't think those two relate to me.
So let me give you a quick hypothetical, right? You're playing, and, you know, insert whatever faction here. You're playing against a Haley 2, and you're playing on Recon 2, right? It's like the bottom of three. You went second, and even going second, you're down like 4-1 on scenario. You know, there's no, like, reasonable line of play that is, like, consistent for you to claw your way back into scenario. So you go for an assassination run. It's not great, but it's, like, what you got, so you go for it. I think the casters that get to pressure scenario are the ones that can generally fall over the easiest.
Yeah, but, mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't know. I'm not sure how to explain it. Let me think about this for a second. I know it's going to be dead air, and I apologize, but
Real quick, let me make another caveat. I'm making this point so that the conversation isn't just control casters have a brand new meta to play in, because they do. I think the thing to be cautious about, if you're going to jump on playing, Denegra 1, Haley 2, Magnus, whatever number he is, Kruger 2, who are other, like, the Harby? Who are the other, like, backbreaking scenario casters? Did I hit all of them, mostly?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. All of those casters are generally not the toughest casters in their faction to kill. Like, I think if you're going to be jumping on that to kind of answer the meta, to answer, like, the environment that we're in, I would caution to say that your handful of first outings are going to be a difficult balance of pressuring scenario and putting your caster in a compromising position. Speaking personally, back from a while ago when I was playing Denegra 1, back when she was just fucking bonkers, like no running, no charging, no special attacks, I made it a fucking hobby to get her assassinated on my feet turn. I was like, well, let's see how you can do it, because if you don't, I'm dead. It was like, oh, you did it. That was weird.
So I don't disagree, but they're not easier to kill now than they were before. Now there's just scenarios that cater to them more than they had previously. They don't necessarily have to play, you don't have to score the center flag with Denny.
Grant, how do metas work? Something becomes common, you bring things to answer it. You now have casters that are pressuring scenario and aren't that difficult to kill. I'll start bringing out the Kane 2s and the other assassination casters of the world.
Gentlemen, yes. can I just... Grant, I think that Brad agrees with you, but he's just...
No, I know.
He agrees with you, but he's also saying that along with the control caster resurgence is going to be a resurgence of casters that can assassinate.
Because
control casters are susceptible to assassination.
Why is Seth here with the voice of reason? Seth, get out. We were busy over here fighting.
Yeah, you more often, all your casts will be like 10 minutes.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, guys, good casts. We settled that argument. No, you're right. I do get that you're kind of agree with me, and you're absolutely right about that. If we do start seeing the return of those casters, you will. I guess that was the point you were making without me hearing it, or without me hearing the part about the assassination casters will come out. I was just hearing, okay, control casters, but they die. It's like, yeah, of course. But I see what you're saying about that. That would shift the meta where you would start seeing those Kane 2s and the other casters that can kill those control casters when they go to put their dick out and make that scenario play to try to score 4 and then hope to live to score that last point. I get that. I think we're on the same page.
Or on the flip side, you start seeing the models like Tiberian and all the other models that just make it very difficult for your opponents to move them. Things that are immune to pushes as like not commonplace as they are against a handful of those casters, it's how they're getting things out of the way is using pushes to get them out of the way.
Well, you know what? I'll tell you, I was listening to another podcast, Fear the Swan, and they're predicting this great return of Haley too. So, I'm curious to see if that one comes true.
I love assassinating Haley, too. Bring her back.
That was not based off of SR 2018. That was simply based off of a conversation talking about popular tricks. I got you.
Yeah, no, it's a strong meta read. I think Haley, 2 is positioned well for the style of Crixlists that are common, especially on, like, the larger convention scene. And I think she'll do well in Steamroller 18. But I think you have to be cautious when you play her. She doesn't feed on as much of the table as she used to, and she's armor 14?
Yes.
That's not great.
And, speaking of caution, I've been trying to hop in here while you guys have been butting
heads.
No worries. One of my big issues that I'm finding, especially with Mirage, is I only have so many solos. And, the solos are in the list to do a job. And now there's two flags that you're really concerning yourself with. And depending on the turn, you're not going to put your caster on that middle flag. So I'm having to make hard choices as to, okay, do I put this this critical support solo on that flag, or do I start building a list with an extra throwaway solo specifically for this scenario?
So that was kind of the conversation I wanted to piggyback into, kind of off the scenarios. But what do these new scenarios do to our list building? So I was in another chat similar to Pete, and part of the conversation was, do our lists that like have generic souls in them that we kind of don't take right now, do we bring in to take them? Like, for example, in Scourge of the Broken Coast and Crix, you have Axiara, this new hot character soul. You have Severa, Prince Money character solo, thank you. The Blood Mistress, usually also another free choice. And then you have the old Raider Captain, which generally wasn't being taken. She's solid, but since you're not taking her for free, you're not really all that incentivized to take her. Do you start bringing those? They do count towards your free points, so that helps out there. But in the theme forces that kind of have the cheap 2 to 3 point souls that don't do a whole lot, do they start seeing their way into lists just because of Mirage and Spread the Nets and those scenarios?
Well, it's funny you say that, because Trish Ceretti and I were knocking back and forth on some Kador lists. And, we were talking just about this very issue that, we need our solos to do so much. Do we have folks that we can just, put onto flags, and are they going to have the range and the staying power to, hold that flag long term? Do we turn to our one mercenary solo? Do we start looking at Alexia, who can create these solos that can run off and score these flags? And, it's a real issue as a Kador player also, because Kador is slow, generally speaking. I know there are some list builds that are very fast, but generally speaking, it's a slower faction. And you need stuff that can cross that center line and contest something far away. And, the quick and easy answer is eliminators, right? But then, it's 5 points and two very valuable models just to be throwing downfield to stop a point from being scored. So I don't have a solution yet. I'm just saying this already came up in list build discussion.
I can tell you what I'm hearing out of Kador.
Okay.
Cosslight Woodsman.
Oh, we've been wanting those guys to be good for so long.
Well, look, I think they're fast enough to run in and contest the flag and recon, so that's pretty great to start, and the flag and Mirage.
Okay. It goes into the hopper of all the different things I could take to help solve these problems.
Yeah, also you'd have to be playing, can't you only take them in, which theme are they in?
Oh, I don't remember those kinds of details. That's why I'm not a very good player.
And if I think they're in the theme that you don't want to play, I could be wrong. So don't crush me on that one if I'm wrong.
I think they're in Jaws.
Oh, okay. Well, then that's fine. I thought they were in like Wolves of Winter or something.
No, I think I can't remember.
I mean, just to pick another faction real quick. Like, if we jump to Circle, when was the last time someone saw a Werewolf on the table? That little it's 2 points and can score a flag though, and I think it's speed 7 to go contest something.
Yep.
Do you think in for that scenario, you actually, because for that center flag, is it possible that you want to start looking at like more durable solos, not that Death 14, Arm 11 stealth solo that's going to die to a blast damage? Like, I know not every faction obviously has something that's, super survivable, but like, just not that I necessarily want to use, like, for example, with Haley 3, like I have Finn who's stealth Arm 14 with 14 boxes that I can get up to Def 16. Like, he might be able to survive camping on that center flag with a bunch of shit getting thrown at him without dying.
But do you want to use him for that purpose?
Well, no. I mean, that's obviously the problem. Like, no, not really. But
I would think you'd want to put, like, baby Haley on there and call it a day. Oh, no, she's not a solo, huh?
Nope. She can contest. She can sit there and contest that flag.
Pete, they don't need to do more.
Yeah.
No, I was just kind of spitballing. I think you're right, because I'm looking at, like, what I take. And again, one faction, but, like, in Signar, I mean, I generally only have Strangeways or my Squire or Junior Again, if it's not like Gravediggers, that's going to go camp a flag. And these flags are a lot further up, I believe, or 1 inch up and closer into the center than you have in, like, say, Spread the Net and some of the other scenarios previously, not in this one. So you don't necessarily want those support solos going and scoring those flags unless it's going to get you, you know, 4 points on the bottom of two, and then maybe it's okay. So I don't know. Maybe you do have to start looking at bringing up. I don't personally, with the list building, I mean, unless it completely changes, I don't see myself throwing more solos in just for this one scenario.
So is there a theme in Signar that gives you free points off solos in the list as well?
Gravediggers, I think Trencher solos still count towards free points.
What about like Stormblade Captains in Storm Division?
Yes, but because of the way the points work out, you're almost always just taking them for free because you want to spend your points on the Lances and the Stormblades. If that makes sense.
No, I understand you.
Like, I don't really want two Stormblade Captains for 10 points when I could take Stormblades for 10 points. Also, their stats are pretty shit, too. They're 12-16 with 5 boxes. Like, they're just going to die.
Sure, but they're a model that will exist on a flag for at least a turn.
Yep. That is correct. It's certainly an interesting conversation, and maybe when you guys, if you think you're going to, I don't see the list building changing where I'm going to start taking more solos just because of, you're already generally getting two for free in almost any theme, obviously unless you're taking a command attachment. I don't see people cutting out a Warjack or a unit just to take one or two more solos to potentially score a flag if you potentially play Mirage.
Well, I guess if your army is really, you know, just doesn't have many solos, you may cut down to a min unit to see if you can get one in there. Because you do need this, you need the solos now with all these scenarios.
Yes, I do agree with that.
All right, then.
Yeah,
why is done. Seth making everyone agree with each other?
I don't know, but we should have him. He, really, there's no argument. Seth's just
I
like,
want to
okay.
fight more.
I know. It's boring if you just agree with each other.
You could always just, you know, message Grant's wife some more if you want to really cause some more trouble.
Yeah, man.
Has she messaged you back at all anymore?
No, just about other stuff now. We're on to other things. Because I was like, yeah, he's just being a dick. We're just joking. Oh. All right.
Hey, Brad, you know, you met my wife that night at dinner, and she really, you know, she thought very well of you. Don't screw that up, please.
Is she on Facebook?
It's not your
computer. So is there any, I guess the only other few things we didn't talk about that I think may have already been mentioned, no more painting requirement in Champions. I'm sure that makes you sad, Pete.
It makes me sad, too.
So the interesting thing with that is it. I've been having this crisis of faith where the older I get, Cole's father told me, quit worrying about painting and just get the shit on the table. And I'm starting to adopt that as a mentality where I'm like, well, I just want to play games. Why am I painting everything? So this was another, you know, chink in the dam where
oh no I'm gonna go cool.
What's that,
Pete, you're a constant disappointment to me.
I know
it's killing me. I understand that you don't want to have limited formats that keep people out of the game, but I like having a painting requirement format out there. I mean, just bring back hardcore. That's so much fun. Have it at a convention. Hey, painting requirement, hardcore, go have a great time. Something. But to have no format with a painting requirement, I was a little disappointed. But I know I'm in the minority on that.
Yeah, that's the point where I was going. Where it's interesting to hear the people that say things like, "Well, that's the only way I'll ever win anything is through painting." And you know, it's one of those things where, okay, if we were to hold at every single one of our steamrollers, we're gonna cut off a little piece for the best painted. We know who's going to win that all the time. So yep. there would have to be some type of mechanism in place. So you could say, okay, all of these models you've already entered, you know, you can't enter them again for best painted.
Yeah, I
know it is absurd. It is absurd. So I don't know a good answer for that because it definitely is, not allowing some of the players that paint. They're more painters than they are players to get the same type of value out of their gaming experience that those that are players versus painters. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
So here's what I will say as somebody who has recently got into painting, at least to the point where the last couple of years I've gotten my shit together to be able to play in Champions, and that's about it. I have never really cared, but the more I play and the how fast they're coming out with new stuff for each faction, I will say I have had a difficult time with some factions where if it is not painted and I look across the table, I can't differentiate some things from some of the other things because I've never seen them before because it's new and it's all unpainted and I don't know who the unit leader is or who the solo is. I had that problem with my own faction at first with like Hitch versus like some of these other models with some other people where I was like, oh, there he is behind all those other dudes. I couldn't tell. Or it was a Gunmage Captain Adept or something else. I didn't know the Gunmage Captain Adept was there because it was primed gray hiding behind something else and it just looked like a normal dude. Didn't even realize it was a solo.
I think that's also a byproduct of PP no longer producing books because you're not, you would, I don't know about you guys, but like when we had the books every once in a while, I'd pull them down, I'd flip through them and be like, oh yeah, they did make a Judicator model. That's
right.
That's coming out eventually, but you're seeing the art as you're reading the stats. And so that's that's cementing what you expect it to look like when it finally hits the table.
I think they're actually doing an okay job with matching the card art with more of what the model is now. And maybe that's just because the pictures are bigger. I'm not sure. But I have noticed that, say, with my Trencher Long Gunners, I was like, oh, that's how I know which one's the UA and which one was the regular guy. I could tell just on the card. And again, that's not something you may look at playing against somebody else. I just think I don't generally care. I don't care about painting requirements, but even I'm sitting there at the rate they're coming out with all this new shit, it's so much easier to tell stuff apart when it's painted. And I'm somebody who always has been pro, I don't give a fuck if your shit's painted. So yeah, that's that.
Right.
Brad doesn't care because he doesn't paint, so he's like, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, so don't get me wrong. I used to, of course, play GW games, which is painting required for all the conventions. I like having painting required on events. I think the armies just look better. I think it was strange when people tell you dice roll better when models are painted. It's just nonsense. But
yes, it is.
Yeah, I don't know. At the same time, I like removing the barrier to entry. Yeah, I don't know. I think I'm indifferent.
All right.
You know what? Like I said before, you get to a point where you just trust the company to, put together something that's going to work long term. A year from now, if we have more players in the game, right, then this was a good thing and it's fine and I'll keep painting and not putting stuff on the table until it's painted and lose games.
Yeah.
That's fine.
As long as they don't do something absurd, in a year from now where they're like, all right, if every model is painted, you get a +1 to your die roll.
Nope. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, don't do that,
Yeah.
That was the worst suggestion I've ever heard.
I've read that.
That's very possible. Yeah, that's pretty possible.
I've read that as a suggestion somewhere where they were saying, to encourage people to play, if you're fully painted, you should get a +1 to go.
Nope. They should be completely independent of each other. The only thing would be if you want to have a separate event that is painting required, that's fine. Do not bring the two anywhere near each other other than that. All right, I think I was going to go into something from the Lockhill thing, but I think we're a little over an hour, so I think this is a good point to wrap it up. Seth, thanks, as always, for coming on, buddy.
Great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course, man. And Anybody got anything else? Well, let's get the fuck out of here. Nope? Okay. Thanks for listening. I'm Grant.
I'm Brad. You better leave that first one in.
I'm Pete. Don't step on
I'm Seth.
Seth. Oh, I did it!
Do it again, guys!
Nope, I'm done. I will fix it.
I'm Brad.
I'm Pete.
We had Seth. I had you. I did it.